My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This is episode 297, and this week I'm speaking with Clifton Harness, co-founder of TestFit, and I asked him, will technology replace the architect? This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, RCAT, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM specifications, and so much more at rcat.com, and FreshBooks, the cloud-based accounting software that makes running your small firm easy, fast, and secure. Spend less time on accounting and more time doing the work you love. Clifton Harness, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. While obtaining his Bachelor of Architecture from the University of Texas at Austin, Clifton Harness was the first BArch to obtain certifications from the McCombs School of Business in business and in real estate. After graduation, Clifton joins Streetlights Residential, a Dallas-based real estate development company. And prior to starting his current company, TestFit, Clifton worked with college roommate Ryan Grieg. Is that how to say that?
Grieg.
Grieg. Yeah. Ryan Grieg. I want to get that right. So it's Ryan Grieg after work on weekends. This work would become Residential Engine, the precursor to TestFit.io. Clifton lives in Dallas with his wife, Annalise, and their golden doodle, Brinkley. Clifton and Annalise are team members at Apartment Life, a ministry devoted to fostering community within apartment buildings. And he's also a member of the current cohort working with our friends over at 060, the AEC Accelerator. We've been focusing on 060 throughout the past few episodes. So you've heard Andrew Zukoski over at Join.Build. We spoke with Jim Rone over at SoLiquid last week. We spoke with Herman, one of the co-founders, Herman Aparicio, of co-founders of 060, back in episode 294. So the last few weeks, you've been hearing all about 060 and the companies that have been working with them. And I'm super excited. I love doing this. I love startups and I love technology and I love hearing about how these companies and their innovative ideas are advancing our profession. So Clifton Harness, God bless you. And thank you for hanging out with us today and sharing a little bit about TestFit. Thanks for being here.
Yeah. We need to clean up our bio, make it sound more fun.
Well, that's no problem because the first question I'm going to ask you is your origin story. So you can clean it up right now. Go back to where you discovered architecture, what inspired you to become an architect, and give us that story from where you started to where you find yourself today with TestFit.
Yeah, great. Yeah, origin story. All right, so I'm not a storyteller, so I'll try to make it as fun as possible. My dad's a real estate developer. He does garden apartments, these sort of 15-acre sites that have the same building copied, all over them. And I sort of remember as a kid looking at that and thinking, man, like, I'm sure we could do better than this. You look at garden apartments and you think, man, like, we probably could design things better than that. And that's what initially got me interested in architecture as a career. It would be a way to help my dad out. In that process, I met some really awesome people. Rick Archer, who's a principal or the CEO at Overland Partners, a firm in San Antonio. He's been a mentor of mine for about 15 years now. And so in the middle of high school, I knew I wanted to go into architecture. And so I started building a relationship with him. And Overland is a very interesting firm in that they don't really have a process. They just have values that they try to make their buildings meet. So, you know, their values are, you know, building is strategic, systemic, sustainable, beautiful, experiential, meaningful, contextual. So, you know, every building should be all of those things. And so their KPIs for the buildings are pretty insane for most, you know, commodity kind of architects to try to accomplish, especially if a developer is, you know, squeezing you for, you know, squeezing the design out of you basically. So I initially, you know, saw architecture as a very, meaningful, long-term career path, you know, something that I could do and be a meaningful member of, you know, my community. Then I go to architecture school, you know, kind of in my bio, it was, you know, I was the first kind of guy that was like, no, I'm going to go get some other business related, you know, certifications. And I actually had to get a studio. I had to convince UT to change my studio time so that I could go attend business classes. And they were, you know, the administration at the time at UT was pretty against doing that. Like, you want to go get business classes? Are you crazy? but the reason why I did that was that connected with, you know, I wanted to figure out how to do real estate development on these really dense, urban infill sites. So I ended up working as an intern for Riverside Resources in Austin, Texas. It's a very small development shop, but they make really impactful buildings. They're really really great. You know, they dot the skyline, and ended up being a development intern there, and they start introducing me to concepts like yield on cost and internal rate of return, and you start to learn that there's this whole other half of the design process that is rooted in finance. And it's sort of like a Rubik's cube, you know, like it's all just one Rubik's cube, but there's different views. You can look at it from the left, you're looking at it from the right. Well, as architects, you're really only looking at the building design. And in order to be the best designer, and this is my opinion, in order to be the best designer you can be, you also need to understand the pro forma and the finance and everything that, that, you know, kind of the lifeblood of the project, which is money and cash flow. So I remember just sort of being mystified by that whole side of the process. So became an intern, started working in real estate development, started to understand finance a little bit better. In that process, I started looking at how weak the connection between pro forma and building is. You know, in the Excel model, it's like, you know, we have 300,000 feet of rentable space, and that's how the building is represented in the financial model. Which, as an architect, like you're just like, wow, that is, it's not even qualitative. You can't win a qualitative design argument with a pro forma because it's all based on quantity. So that's, I remember thinking, man, like that's something that could be completely disrupted if we start changing how we do pro formas. So at this point in time, I am nearing my end of college. I got married before I graduated. Lovely bride, Annalise. She had been out of school for about a year, and you know, B arcs are 5 years, so I was a year behind. And she wanted to move to Dallas to go to DTS, which is a Dallas Theological Seminary. And so I was looking at companies in Dallas, and all my peers are, you know, they're going to go work at HKS, and we're going to go work at these, you know, the three letter acronym firms, and or Corgan, or, you know, there's some really great design firms in Dallas. But I was looking around for a development company that would give a damn about design. And there was this really interesting company in Dallas called Streetlights Residential. And they have, they were doing the vertical integration, you know, before vertical integration was cool. so they have, you know, the construction, company, the design company, the development company, the investment company, and all these companies are housed under the same roof. So you couldn't ask for a better place to really learn, as many parts of the process, as you could. And up until this time, like, my experience in architecture had been, you know, red lines and, you know, draw, wall details. And, you know, you like, you don't really know why you're drawing these wall details because you're young and you don't really understand that there's a whole building that has all these different materials. And, but thankfully that kind of stuff was super boring to me. And I was more interested in like how the whole deal comes together and how the, you know, how the site plan interacts with the pro forma. And at Streetlights, they gave me, really two, I was running kind of two jobs at the same time, working, you know, 60, 70 hours a week. The first half of my job was site planning, laying out buildings, you know, relationship between building and parking and, you know, solving unit mixes, which means, you know, you're getting the right, quantities of units, of different types, you know, small studio units compared to large two bedroom units, you know, different markets perform based off of those unit mixes. The other half of my job was drawing unit plans. So we had, you know, this whole, you know, 10,000 unit plans or something that they had built, not 10,000, it might be 250 different unit plans that they had already built in the last couple of years. And our job was to consolidate those into a kit of parts that could be, reusable, you know, for the next 30 projects or something. So we took, you know, these 200 units, we boiled it down to 8. We had 8 units that we use in every single project. And so when you're working in this sort of vertically integrated company, you're trying to eliminate as many variables as possible, so that everybody can be on the same page and everybody can move more quickly. So the site plan and the kit of parts approach, helped, you know, not just the design group, but the construction team. You know, they had the kit of parts just completely priced out. They knew, you know, how many dishwashers we'd need, how many square feet of tile we'd need. We would know within 15 minutes. You know, it was really incredible kind of process. But what I noticed was the chink in the entire thing was the site planning. It took forever to get a single iteration done. And as many architects know, you know, the more iterations you can go through, typically the better the end result. And so I started looking out in the industry of different generative design solutions that were out there. They were all pretty much impossible for a single person to figure out how to do it in an afternoon. So, you know, that's kind of when the thinking about doing test fit as a software started to percolate in my head. I had done a little bit of stuff in undergrad, but it was I didn't have a vocabulary to really apply it to a professional setting. So Streetlights gave me that vocabulary, and I connected with Ryan Grieg, who was my roommate for a couple of years while in Austin at the University of Texas, and he's just a brilliant software engineer. And I said, you know, Ryan, I have these very specific business related problems. You know, do you think that you could help me solve them? And a lot of them are just math based, and, you know, software guys love math. He's really great at math. And so the first thing he built was like a terminal application that would help me solve a unit mix. And we sort of built on that from there. And we did it on nights and weekends for about a year and a half. Ryan ended up getting laid off from his mobile game development company, which, you know, mobile games is probably even a riskier industry to be in than architecture, because it ebbs and flows pretty horrendously. And so he started working on, it was called Residential Engine at the time. We hadn't thought of marketing or branding or anything. We just said, oh, we'll just call it Residential Engine. And we did a beta. We had a couple of customers, early adopters, test it out. And the moment when we had a development guy gets to flex the site plan in real time, you know, he goes, this is the future. This is how we're going to do things in the future. And so, we ended up shipping, or I ended up quitting my job at Streetlights. You know, the C-level leadership there was basically like, either you're going to quit and go do this, or you'll work here and be miserable and you'll miss out on a really cool opportunity in your life. And so they've been really supportive. They've been a paying customer, for a while now. And, couldn't be more thankful for Streetlights and what they've done for us.
Streetlights, they weren't, or maybe there wasn't an opportunity for that, but they weren't interested in having you develop it in-house with them? Or did you not ever give them that opportunity?
No, we pitched it. But I think to Doug Chesnut's credit, the CEO there, he's kind of like, we're not a software mm-hmm. company. Like, you'll have yep. a better chance of doing this on your own.
Right. So they know their strengths. They don't want to dive into a new technology that they're not equipped. They're focused, clearly focused on doing what they're doing and making that as efficient and effective as possible. This would distract yeah. them from that. That
yeah. Their mission is to do, you know, 3,000 units a year or something, mm-hmm. a huge amount of units. And, while building software for that sounds really useful, it's not their core mission.
Right. Right. Okay. So he encouraged you to take it and run with it.
He literally kicked me out of the nest, basically. yeah.
And so what did you do after that? So now you're out and now you have to do this full time. Was it full confidence, or was there a little bit of panic involved, or what do you do?
Oh, so much panic, man. You're running a not venture backed customer funded startup and you only have like one customer. You know, you kind of, the other day I was talking to one of our advisors and he's like, well, how'd you get this thing off the ground? And, literally sitting in a Starbucks, from 7:30 in the morning to 10 PM, crawling the internet, just finding people that I think might be interested, copying, you know, guessing email addresses, you know, people hide their email address from people like me. but I got pretty good at guessing them. And in the first 30 days, I sent, I think, well over 3,000 or 4,000 emails, to industry people. And that's what got us our first, I think, 15 customers. So if you're paying attention, the hit rate for sales is extremely low. 15 out of 3,000 is pretty, pretty low. But we had no credibility, no track record, at that point in time. Our first couple of customers, STG Design in Austin, and then, Allen Harrison Company in Houston, first two.
So before we get into what TestFit is, I want to know what Annalise thought when you lost your job and you were about to take on this. Was she fully supportive and confident that this was the right direction, or was there some resistance?
Yeah. So, Streetlights, they kicked me out sort of like, you need to go do this, mm-hmm. but they didn't give me, like, they didn't fire me or lay me off.
Right.
It was, about a year in, they said, oh, like, so you're actually, making money. Okay. So we'll fill your position. So they had left my position open for me to come back in case I had failed. But Annalise, she knew that I always wanted to have my own company at some point. But she thought that it would be like, when I was in my 40s or when I had learned about the world, you know, and so she was like, well, we just had to really move that timetable up quite a bit. And so I made a budget, you know, so, okay, we're not going to spend more than this amount of money in savings. And And we definitely did spend more than that amount of money in savings to get tested off the ground, but it was money well spent, I think. Yeah, she you know, today she was like, you know, when are we gonna start trying for kids and when are we gonna buy a house? And you know, I'm like, well, we gotta de-risk the company a little bit more before we can start doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I ask, because it's, you know, there's, it's not just you making these decisions, right? When you're married and you have a family, it's you're not making those decisions all by yourself.
True. Yeah. She was the hardest one to convince, I think, out of everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. My parents are like, yeah, go do it. You know, my wife's like, hey, but we have savings that we should probably, you know, not spend.
Right. Right. So tell us about TestFit. What is TestFit, so we can understand what it is and how it works?
Yeah. So I'm speaking to architects, so I'll give you the architecture version. It's practical generative design. And that means that within 45 minutes of touching our software, you'll be able to generate something useful. Sometimes less than, you know, 45 minutes, but you know, you just say 45 minutes. And what practical generative design means is that we try to solve problems in the planning, you know, part of the design phase or design process that have already been solved before. So the current process is roll out a piece of trace paper on top of some kind of survey and just start drawing things with a scale in your hand. Well, most designers have already solved that problem a million times.
Right.
If you're a site planner by trade, you've literally site planned things hundreds of thousands of times, either in your head or physically doing it. So we said, okay, we're just going to embed sort of the knowledge of a designer into an algorithm and see what kind of good results we get out of that. So for example, never draw parking garages, you know, rectangular parking garages ever again. Our software just takes care of that. It draws the ramp. It counts all the parking stalls for you. It draws it to your specifications of what dimensions of parking stalls you want. How many levels tall is it? So whenever I see designers roll out trace paper and draw a parking garage, I'm like, you're wasting your time. Like, this has literally been solved with software. You don't need to do this again. And then we solved some basic massing problems. So TestFit is a new urbanistic modeling tool. So it's trying to hold down property edges, trying to do denser buildings. And, you know, the thing about housing buildings is that they're very algorithmic. You know, draw your double-loaded corridor, place it around a garage. You know, then you put the units on top of the, you know, the corridor hosts the units, the staircases are hosted by the corridor as well. So we took what I had learned, you know, the hard way, while site planning, you know, with trace paper and fat tip, you know, flare tip markers, and we codified it, into, generative design. So it's generative, it generates stuff. But we call it practical because, we have a lot of co-creation tools, and what co-creation means is, you're partnering with software to get a job done. It's not you versus the software, it's you with the software to get the job done. So, the best co-creation tool that I think we've shipped with so far is a manual massing mode, where like TestFit will generate just garbage sort of partie. And so we have this manual mode that you can go in as a designer and fix it and make it better. So that's when the software is good at counting units and solving parking stalls, and it's good at like sort of the boring stuff. And as a designer, you can start doing the more important things, which is like, how do we address the street? What is the scale of the building, and you know, what are our setbacks and being compliant?
So for an example, if we have an empty lot in a dense urban environment and we wanted to design a new building for that space, TestFit very quickly will give you multiple solutions for how that space can be used, given the parameters that you give it, correct?
So we'll give you one solution. We'll automatically generate one solution. You as the user are responsible for generating more solutions. Our goal is to not do this sort of cloud compute model where you throw a design problem into the ether and you expect it to find a good solution for you. That's actually pretty stupid. And it's a waste of electricity in my mind. So instead we try to generate, you know, a building diagram that is useful from the very beginning, and then allow the designer to, fix it, you know, to make it better. We do have some, you know, generative design tools that'll just generate a bunch of stuff. But at the end of the day, it's just a bunch of stuff. It's not really useful. What's more useful is if you craft with some kind of intention every single scheme that goes into, you know, to comparing schemes.
We'll be right back to our conversation after this quick break to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, RCAT, and FreshBooks. Have you been to RCAT.com recently? It's the number one most used website for finding building product information, and it has a new look. RCAT has updated their site to get you the data that you want that much faster. Their search now allows you to choose what kind of information you want, like CAD, BIM specifications, and you only get those results. Just that data, that's all you're going to get. RCAT is also constantly fine-tuning their search engine to make sure you keep getting the information that you ask for. Fast and easy. Of course, it's still free and it requires no registration, not even a login. It doesn't require any email. It does not require any money. It's free. If you need building product information and you haven't yet used RCAT, it's time to go check it out. If you've never tried RCAT, head over to RCAT.com and try it out. You'll be glad that you did. That's RCAT.com, ARCAT.com. Go check it out and let them know that Entree Architect sent you. In case you were wondering, 192 hours works out to about 2 business days every month. 2 business days. Well, why the math? If you're an architect and you're using FreshBooks cloud accounting software, that's the amount of admin time that you can save every year. How? Well, FreshBooks is so fast and so easy to use that it changes the way that you deal with your paperwork. FreshBooks is the simplest way to be more productive, more organized, and most importantly, it will get you paid quickly. You can create and send really professional-looking invoices in under 30 seconds. And when you email a client an invoice, FreshBooks can show you whether they've seen it, which puts an end to that guessing game on, you know, whether they got that invoice or not. If waiting for a client's check in the mail is slowing you down, slowing down that cash flow, with literally 2 clicks, you can set yourself up to receive online payments. Oh, and your clients, they will love paying by credit card straight from their invoice. FreshBooks helps you avoid having that awkward talk with your clients about past due payments. FreshBooks automates late payment email reminders. This is my favorite part. So you can spend less time chasing payments and more time working on your projects. If you have any questions whatsoever, FreshBooks' award-winning customer service is amazingly helpful. They're super friendly and they have zero attitude. Plus, a real live person usually answers in 3 rings or less. To claim your month-long unrestricted free trial, go to entrearchitect.com/freshbooks and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's entrearchitect.com/freshbooks. RCAT and FreshBooks. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So is that one design, that one layout that it generates, is that from the algorithm's point of view, is it the best solution for that site?
No.
So what is it? What is it? What's the benefit of using TestFit for that example?
Yeah, so everybody's saying, okay, well, I want the most efficient building, I want the best building, I want the, you know, to whose KPIs.
Mm-hmm, right.
So if you ask the land seller, the best building is the one that, you know, gives them the most amount of money for their land. If you ask the architect, it's one that's really well crafted and it has a base, a middle, a top. It's got, you know, rhythm and on this edge, and it's got, you know, all the sort of design oriented goals, you know, achieved. If you ask the developer, well, it's the one that gives him the most yield on cost or the, you know, ROI. So everybody's got a very different opinion about what the most efficient building is. And you could build a system to solve for all of those opinions that's done with, you know, algorithms, but the human mind can already do that really well. So why rebuild, you know, a system like that? So the point of TestFit is we can generate options, you know, 100 times faster. We can generate parties 100 times faster, and it's all quantitatively, it's all been tabulated for you. So, you know, guys that are drawing out parking and counting parking stalls manually, you're wasting your time. That shouldn't be part of your job. That should not be something that you have to do. And furthermore, you're a human, you're fallible. You're going to count things wrong. So, you know, software is an algorithm. It's a procedure for counting things, and it's better at it than we are.
So we're using it for the areas that are sort of repetitive and redundant and the dumb part of the buildings, to put it into an easy way to look at it. And then the things that take more thought and more design and more skill, that's the work that we're putting in addition to, or an overlay to the
right.
Dumb side of the building.
Right. All we're a really solid skeleton generator for, you know, the 90% of the building that is algorithmically generated. The other, you know, I got in trouble on a LinkedIn article that I wrote because I said, you know, the future of architecture is basically the 10% of the building that an algorithm can't kind of figure out. So what that means is like the facade, the common spaces that have, you know, design intervention from the sort of repetitive commodity parts of the building, that's really going to be where the future of architecture in commodity buildings is going to be. The stuff, you know, especially if you get this stuff linked up to a factory, as a designer, you're more of like a managing the whole sort of logistics process, more so than a designer.
So I think when architects, and that's who's listening here, mostly architects, when they hear that and they see software like TestFit, they get nervous. You know, they feel threatened that technology, this is very early on in where this technology is going. What do you say to those architects that see their profession being taken over by technology?
Yeah. So I've got a Bachelor of Architecture, and what I did was partner with a software engineer. The easy answer, I think, is look, you're going to need to do a lot more software. You're going to need to start building software. You're going to need to start doing more computational design. You're going to need to start doing things, in a much more automated way. That's on sort of the process side of things. But on the product side of things, the profession of architecture is going to look very different in 15 years. You're going to be solving far more complicated problems than just buildings, you know, societal problems. That's where the future.
Where do you see the future of architecture going? I've had this conversation with other people. People have heard me talk about this in the past. What is your take on where the profession is going, if they're willing to evolve and go there with it?
Yeah. So, at our very basic, thing that every architect is a problem solver. But we're also can live in the subjective world. So we're an objective problem solver that lives in a subjective world. So you can apply that problem to, or that problem solving ability to like affordable housing and, things that homelessness is a good example. And I would look at Overland Partners, really. They do some pretty interesting work around designing stuff. But most of the time, or some of the time, they'll come back at their client with, you know, this isn't really a design problem. Like, you might need to restructure how your organization thinks, you know, instead of applying a, you know, design or a new, instead of building a 2 million square foot office building, why don't we just restructure how the company works currently? So your role as a consultant, to, you know, your client is going to not just be, you know, for the building itself. There's way more things, that we can solve.
Yeah.
And we can monetize our time for.
Yeah, I agree. I think that architects, the definition of architecture is going to change. The role of the architect is going to change. And those architects that evolve with that, those changes will thrive. And those architects that resist that change and try to hold on to the tradition in the past, while technology and software and computers take over much of the work that we used to do because we had to, because there were not tools that allowed us to do it more efficiently or more effectively. If we don't evolve, we become obsolete. And some other profession takes over the areas of construction and building and the built environment that we could control, that we could have an impact on, because someone's going to take on that role. And if we don't, someone else will.
Yeah, I mean, it just, you can kind of look at, let's look at WeWork for a second. Big kind of implosion at the end there, but, you know, Case was a computational design company that did a lot of architectural design work. WeWork acquired Case because they could do interior fit outs for like 50 cents a square foot or something. And the typical architect is like $5 a square foot. So they had done it by automating a lot of things. So there are going to be firms that can figure out the process. I think in architecture, we're really good at products, right? We're really good at this is the finished result. Here's the renderings, you know, here's Inkscape. We already have a photoreal rendering software. You know, this is what it's going to look like. But I only think about 10% of architects are really focused on process. How you get from point A to point B and how you can do it much more effectively. And I'm one of the weird, you know, you go to these BIM conferences and you're amongst your people because, we're all the weirdos that are in that 10% that are just really focused on, you know, okay, how do we just move data and how do we just solve these problems quickly, instead of waiting, you know, long periods of time for answers to, you know, questions to be answered.
Yeah. I think that also not only is the profession changing, but I think the generation of architects that are coming into the profession are already coming in with that mindset that technology is here, that we can use that technology, that we will use it to our benefit. The profession, they're much more flexible in what the profession is and the definition of what architects do. The role of the architect is much broader for the generation that's coming in today. When you speak with them, they speak differently. They're more entrepreneurial. They're more problem solvers. They're using the technology. They've been brought up with technology. It's just part of their DNA. It's not something it's no longer just a tool that we're using. It's part of the process. It's part of creating. And so the profession will change with that as well, just through the evolution of the people who are becoming architects.
Yeah. So let's just look at like red lines for a second. A generational difference in red lines. The early on, my first, you know, sort of intern job, you know, here's a stack of plans that have been redlined. And your job is to go into the CAD file and like literally change, you know, words or move a dimension string because it was annoying or something. I don't see a lot of millennials wanting to print out a giant stack of paper and then writing out all the red lines and then handing them to somebody else. You know, you're doubling the effort, right? You're saying we need to change this part of this thing. And it would take you the same amount of effort to just do it in the software as it would to write it out in a red line. So redlining, I think eventually, will be a shadow of what it is today. you also are going to use, you know, Bluebeam and stuff that's more collaborative, and you can start to share red lines with people, and, you know, it's no longer on this analog piece of paper that can get lost in the shredder. So that's one thing that I see is, like, immediately when I came into the architecture profession, I was like, why isn't this guy just fixing this stuff on his own? Because it would, you know, and you kind of learn that, well, he's not really comfortable in Revit. So that's why he wants to have it printed out. And so, you know, so like that kind of guy, he's, you know, no longer fits with the technology. I'm sure there's a lot more examples, but redlining is like something that everybody is experienced.
That's a very good example. So we talked a little bit, Clifton, about the future of architecture and where it's going and where we can go with it. What's the future of TestFit? What do you imagine TestFit becomes, and how does it change the way we do architecture?
Yeah, so we're a little bit different than some of the other kind of startup companies. We are not venture funded. We're customer funded. So at this point in time, the future of our roadmap is really governed by what our customers want. And they like the concept, almost universally. The concept is liked, but it's a matter of creating, you know, the generative design algorithms that can address different market sectors, and creating the logic to solve more complicated buildings. So it's really solid at doing, you know, like 5% of the market today. But if I'm a firm owner and, you know, we're going to invest in TestFit, which is, you know, pretty expensive software. It's more expensive than Revit. It's got to do more for me as a firm owner. So in the near term, we're answering to customer requests and building, you know, a more stable solution. You know, it's got bugs and stuff. But in the long run, we're going to try to be a more generalized solver that can do more building types and really affect the bottom line for some of these smaller firms that maybe don't have enough money to really hire a computational designer or somebody that can automate some of this stuff for them.
Is the lack of venture funding a strategic decision, or is it that it's difficult to find funding at this point?
No, not difficult to find it, because we're a startup that is making money and has
right.
customers and
That's
has traction.
Why I asked.
Not difficult to find it. It's finding the right money that is hard.
So it's a strategic decision. You've decided that you don't want to be bound to a venture capitalist at this point.
Right. At this point, yeah. Unless it is like a home run, like a group that really feels like they can smart money is really mm-hmm. kind of what we're looking for. You know, I'm not going to go take like $1 million from some Russian oligarch that is just trying to get money out of Russia, right? Like, sorry, I'm not doing that.
Yeah. All right, Clifton. So what is one thing a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow? That's a question that I ask everybody, and I'd love to get your thought on that answer, an answer for that question.
Yeah, my initial thought is like, talk to Jam, JMB. They're in our cohort at 060. They're really focused on how they can provide value for, you know, mid-sized to small-sized firms, which I guess is like anywhere between like 15 people and below. They've got an interesting game plan. But on the technology side, I would really focus on your tech stack. You can't keep thinking of in terms of, you know, we're an AutoCAD firm or we're a Revit firm or we're a, you know, Windows firm or, you know, we're a Mac firm. It's no longer okay to do that. You've got to use the best tool for the job at hand. So if you can't figure out a way to be efficient with your software, you know, it's like, what's a good analog example? So if you're using a rock to hammer in a nail, you know, not really the best tool for the job. So use a nail. Or he used a nail to hammer in another nail.
That would not be very efficient.
It's true, but you know, whenever someone rolls out trace paper and starts a whole project again, I'm like, well, you're nailing in a nail with a nail, right? Yeah. You want to find the hammer. You want to find a good solid hammer. And so thinking in terms of a tech stack is how software industry thinks. In architecture, when you start thinking the same way. And it can be something small like billing. You know, if you're using QuickBooks, well, it's not the best solution for an architecture firm anymore. I might actually take a look at Monograph. It's it's really a great UX kind of software, but it's built specifically for architecture firms. Yeah. You know, it helps track your time. And Robert Ewan, you know, he's an architect and he's helping, you know, build software for architecture.
Yeah. Robert's a good friend of mine and an advisor, sort of an informal advisor to Entree Architect. Been on the show several times. We'll put links on the show notes for that as well. I agree. Monograph is a beautiful software. One of my favorite things. And he's actually Monograph is a membership sponsor here at Entree Architect. And so, I agree. Check out Monograph. Monograph.io. We'll have links to that.
Yeah, and I didn't even get paid for that spot.
Robert will appreciate it.
Another thing, if you're interested in doing modular, go find a factory. Go find somebody that does modular. Small firms can easily kind of. The interesting thing about small firms is that they can move very quickly. If they choose to move quickly, they can. They don't have to go through a committee. They don't have to do anything to get, you know, this process approved or whatever. You can just go. So, you know, Joel Hutchins at Splash Modular, you know, they do bathroom pods and they're really, really good at bathroom pods. So don't reinvent the wheel. Don't try to create your own bathroom pod. Just talk to them. They know how to do it.
That's some great advice. I think that there are many architects that have those ideas and have the innovative solutions to the problems that we see in the world. And I think a lot of us, because of the personalities of most architects or many architects, we're afraid. You know, there's risk involved in some of that. And I know that from firsthand with some of the decisions I've made over the years. It takes a lot of courage to break through that fear, to get to where you want to go and solve some of the problems that you want to solve. Entree Architect is a perfect example of that, of the idea that I had for that and what I wanted it to become. I had to make some decisions to push through that fear, to keep moving forward. So if you have an idea like that, I would definitely take up Clifton and his suggestion to just go do it, you know, just make it happen. And find some people who are doing innovative things and surround yourself with those people so you can find the courage together to make those things happen. The website is testfit.io. You can go check it out. They have some great information, explains exactly what it is, has a great video, so you can see how it works. You can even get a demo. You can sign up for a demo and get a demo for it. Clifton, this has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you about TestFit and about the future of architecture and where we may find ourselves in the not too far distant future. Thanks for joining us today and sharing your knowledge here at Entree Architect Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really appreciate the platform, opportunity to talk about what we do. And we're open to connecting with anybody that's interested in us as well.
Is the best place to connect with you on testfit.io? Is there a place to connect with you there?
Yeah, there's chat bubbles. There's a million ways to give us your contact information. You also send me an email. It's just clifton@testfit.io. We're on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm all over the place.
All right. Sounds good. We'll have links to all of that on the show notes. It's episode 297, entrearchitect.com/episode297. Clifton, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you've been listening to episode 297 with Clifton Harness of TestFit. If you like this show, if you have found some value, if this inspired you or motivated you, or you think someone that you know might benefit from listening to this, share this link with a friend. Share this episode. It's episode 297, and the link
is entrearchitect.com/episode297. Please share it with a friend. If you haven't visited our new homepage at entrearchitect.com, now's the time. Head over there now. Check it out. We redesigned it to be more useful for small firm architects like you. Find everything you need to help you build a better business. Links to this podcast, a search engine to find all the articles, resources, podcast episodes, everything we do. You can just search for it. It'll pop right up there for you. Access to powerful products and resources, and access to all our Entree Architect membership levels. It's all there at entrearchitect.com. It's all there in one place for you right now, entrearchitect.com. Go check it out and let me know what you think. Let me know if we can make it even better. How can we make it better? How can we help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect? Let us know. Love, learn, and share what you know. Thanks for listening this week. Have a great one.